Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the mental health campaigner Marjorie Wallace, founder and chief executive of the charity SANE. Her work revolves around ensuring those who need support for their problems find not just a sympathetic and understanding ear, but the practical help they need to cope and carry on with their lives. It's a vital service and one she feels passionately about. But it wasn't her first choice. A talented pianist, she had planned to study at the Royal Academy of Music. Instead, she ended up with a degree in philosophy and psychology, landing a job on a TV show that was the epitome of all that was hip and happening in 60s Britain, The Frost Programme. Her print journalism won awards at the Sunday Times. She was part of the team whose landmark investigation uncovered the devastating effects of thalidomide. She says, "I have lived life on the edge and I want to give a voice to other people on the edge. I would like to be able to forgive myself for my frailties," and so say all of us. I think Marjorie Wallace about forgiving ourselves our frailties. We shall talk about your life in detail and the fascinating twists and turns that it has taken. It would be fair to say, I think, that lots of people listening will know the name Marjorie Wallace and they will certainly recognise you when they see you on television. You come up always in reports about government plans for social care and mental health care, about funding. When you've been out there in public for 30 years championing a cause, how comfortable is it for you to sit with me today and think, oh gosh, I've actually got to fill the time talking about me?
Well, as you know, I was an investigative journalist and for many, many years a journalist. And one of kind of rules of journalism was that you didn't talk about yourself. You didn't put yourself into it. And even sometimes bylines were considered a little bit unacceptable. So I'm not used to talking about myself. And I feel, I must say, frankly, rather nervous about disclosing some of the feelings and the experiences.
People will learn a lot about you today, not just, I hope, by what you're going to tell me, but also by your music. It would be fair to say that music is absolutely central to your life. You are passionate about music.
I've been passionate about music because, with my mother being a pianist, I grew up with music. It's in my DNA.
Let's then hear your first piece of music this morning, Marjorie Wallace. Tell me what this is and tell me particularly why you've chosen it.
I've chosen Chopin's Ballade No. 4 in F minor because my mother was a gifted pianist, but she didn't become a concert pianist because she followed my father, who was a civil engineer, all over Africa. But wherever they went, she had a piano carried with her. And at sundown every night, whether or not they were in the bush, wherever they were, she would play the piano. And her favourite composer was Chopin. But I have another reason for Chopin, because much later on, when I was a student, I met this charming Polish emigre psychiatrist, very attractive, and I fell in love with him. He came from an aristocratic Polish family. He was a count. And then he took me back to Poland at the height of the Cold War. And we went to these estates that he used to own, his family used to own. And one of those was Zelazowa Wola, which is just outside Warsaw. And it is the very estate on which Chopin was born, because Nicholas Chopin, Chopin's father, was tutor to the Skarbek children. Well, you can imagine, with all I felt about Chopin, that probably sealed my fate. But I had to wait many years before I actually married him.
Thank you.
That was Chopin's Ballade No. 4 in F minor, Opus 52, played there by Vladimir Ashkenazy. Marjorie Wallace, you chose that principally, you said, because your mother was this terrifically accomplished pianist, and she would take her piano wherever her marriage led her, including Nairobi. That's, I think, where you were born in 1943. What had taken your parents there?
Well, my father was a civil engineer, and he went out in his 20s to map railways. So he was on safari, sort of cutting through the bush, mapping railways. And my mother followed him, and she followed him all over Africa. Our weekends were spent in the safari park outside Nairobi or driving down to Durban. I remember the vast skies. I remember actually also the darker undercurrents that there were. I remember going into the room one night and seeing my mother, and she had a gun with this mother-of-pearl handle under her pillow, because it was before Marmal, but it was beginning of the unrest. I remember tales of people being ambushed in the roads. So there was always this mixture of this, the utter beauty and then those undercurrents of fear and darkness.
Your family went, first of all, to Greece, where, of course, you went with them. Your father's travels as an engineer. You spent a year there, then on to South Africa. And then it was Surrey, which you found just, what a terrible disappointment.
Yes, I used to always say to people, you know, I don't really belong here, you know. I'm from Africa, you know. And I never got used to, really, the routine. I didn't get used to the suburban life, and really never forgave my parents for leaving this exotic landscape.
How did you get on at school in Surrey?
I did all right at school. I was very, very keen on poetry. And in fact, before I'd been at school in Surrey, when I was in Africa, I think I was 6 years old, I remember that I learnt the whole of the Rime of the Ancient Mariner.
The whole of it?
Yes. I think it's 140 stanzas.
Yeah.
And I was taken with this water, water everywhere and not a drop to drink and the long grey beard and glittering eye. I was so excited by this. And the teachers couldn't believe it, so they then had to recite it to the class. And I did. And from then on, I just learned poetry by heart, and I would be reading it under the bedclothes at night with a torch. And I was absolutely fueled by these words and these images and the mystery and the magic romance.
Let's have another piece of music then, Marjorie Wallace. We're going to hear your second piece of music.
Well, the second track is the soundtrack from a film which was very famous in the 1960s called Les Parapluies de Cherbourg, The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. The story is very simple. It's a beautiful girl, played by Catherine Deneuve, and she works in an umbrella shop and she falls in love with the local mechanic, Guy. He's drafted to the Algerian War. She becomes pregnant before he goes. He comes back, but it's too late. She's married to a wealthy older man, has a child. He's married another woman. And it brings back to me all that kind of heartbreak of when one's in one's 20s, you know, waiting for someone to return, waiting for the telephone call that doesn't come, waiting for the letter that never arrives, and then gradually that bittersweet reconciliation to loss. Nous nous retrouverons et nous serons.
That was Devona Garage from the film Parapluies de Cherbourg, sung by Daniel Licari and José Bartel. Marjorie Wallace, as well as a facility with language then, you also had a considerable facility with music because you won yourself a place at the Royal Academy. But you didn't stay. Tell me what happened.
I left school at 15 to do music, and I was going to do singing as well. But I was put off by that, all right, Kirsty, because I thought I was going to be Tosca or Isolde or Madame Butterfly. But I was told in no uncertain terms that I could only do a soubrette, a maid's part, and that was the most my voice could ever carry. So that was a bit of a downer. And then with the piano, I thought, you know, I'd be playing my Chopin, I'd be doing concertos. But I went to the academy and I just listened for a day to the competition and I fled.
For a day?
I think it was maybe a few days, but I knew that I had the love of music, but I did not have that incredible technique and understanding of music which it takes. So I did my A-levels and then got a place at University College London to study, can you beat it, logic and the scientific method. And after a year of that, I found it all too abstract. So I asked to change to psychology, experimental psychology. So in the end, I did a degree in both.
Let's have some more music. Marjorie Wallace, tell me about your third one today. What is it and why have you picked it?
Well, when I left university, I certainly didn't want to stay in the academic field. And I wanted to join what was going on in the rest of the world, the swinging 60s of London. And so I was lucky enough to get a job as one of the first trainee researchers in independent television. And one of my very first assignments was to join a small team for the Frost programme. This was David Frost's first incursion into serious television, three nights a week at Wembley. But alongside me were people like John Cleese, Tim Brooke-Taylor, and we used to sort of have great fun. But also, we used to have the ferret song, which was like our morning assembly anthem. And it was so ridiculous that I would like that on my island because it would always make me laugh and remember those very exciting, as David Frost would say, super days.
That was the Ferret Song, sung by John Cleese and the Loving Pruneful. And I have to tell you, Marjorie, that I think is the first time in 73 years that Desert Island Discs has enjoyed that track. And it was chosen by you because it was the song that reminds you so much of working with David Frost. It sounds glamorous. I'm imagining it was damned hard work.
It was terribly stressful. We would have to come in with at least five ideas. And then, while the jokesmiths were paid for 2 minutes worth jokes, as much as we were paid for working 16-hour days, we had to go out and hunt down the victims. And David Frost would say, could you just get hold of Ian Smith in Rhodesia? Here's the telephone number. And we just had to do it. And it was very stressful. And at the end of the first series, I had a bleeding ulcer. So it was stressful, but it was so exciting. And these people that we worked with then became the very famous, the Monty Pythons, the Two Ronnies, the Goodies. David had an immense talent for picking really brilliant writers and comedians.
So you would be working, what, 16, 18-hour days? Was there much time for personal life? I mean, were you, did you have boyfriends and so on?
I think, Kirsty, we possibly shouldn't go down this road.
Oh, I don't know.
I'm not sure. I got to know a great number of people because actually between the Frost programme series, I was in charge of what was called religious programmes. Mm-hmm. And the way I tackled that with a colleague of mine was I made a list of all the people in swinging London I wanted to meet. And then I would invent programmes around them, like Sins for Modern Sinners or Dialogue with Doubt or My Favourite Poems. And then the way it went was that they had lunch with me and then they recorded the programmes with me. And I got to know a lot of people. Bernard Levin was one of the people I got to know, Robert Key. I just simply had a list and went through that and got to know very many of the figures of that era.
Time for some more music, Marjorie Wallace. We're going to hear some Verdi now. Just tell me your reason for picking this.
Well, La Traviata has a very, very personal meaning for me because when I met my husband, whom we always called the Count, he always called me Traviata. He would say, darling, Traviata. And I was so naive when I met him as a student. I thought that meant the frail one. And it was a bit later I realised that it actually meant the fallen woman. But by that time it was too late. That was my name. And he used to take me to the opera. And this particular duet, which I've chosen, is something that means a great deal to me. Here's Violetta. She is a courtesan. She's dying from consumption. And for the first time, she meets someone that she loves, Alfredo. And they go off to live idyllically in the countryside. And then his father, Germont, comes to her and says, "Your affair is going to spoil my daughter's chances of marriage. Can you sacrifice your love and return to Paris?" And she reluctantly and very nobly agrees.
Dite al Giovini from Verdi's La Traviata, sung there by Cheryl Milnes and Iliano Cotrobash. Your reason for choosing that, Marjorie Wallace, was because you said it was, you know, principally about sacrifice. This is the father talking about sacrifice to the daughter and to her lover. Sacrifice is something you know a little bit about yourself, given your relationship with this man. You were deeply in love with him and having this relationship, and it was a long time before you realised that there was plenty else going on in his life.
Yes, I found that he was married and that he had three, then four children. Eventually, I had my first son, Sasha, with him, but I didn't marry him then. I married him 2 years later, so I was a single mother for 2.5 years.
You did then go on to marry and have two further children. Did you have a settled family life?
It wasn't really a very settled family life. In fact, much of the time I was looking after the children on my own. And only the other day, Stefan was telling me, he was saying, "You know, Mum, in the morning it's a bit like Russian roulette. Were you going to get one child dressed, going to the right school at the right time?" And we never knew what was going to happen. And on holidays, I was also a little bit cavalier. We didn't book hotels or do anything sensible like that. And I would want to put on some music that coincided with the scenery. And so I would actually have a video camera that through the roof of the car, and I would have on the music, the Requiem, Mozart Requiem, to go with it. And I would have to get the exact moment when the sun was setting, when the Requiem finished. And if it didn't work, we'd have to drive back and go and do it again.
You are kidding.
And the children were getting tired and hungry in the back of the car, and I would never have a return ticket. It was always, "Oh, let's just go on a little bit. There's another hotel around the corner. There's another adventure." And I used to have a little case in case we had to go somewhere and stay longer. And they now carry, all of them, a just-in-case case.
Tell me then about your fifth disc of the morning.
Three of my four children are musicians. My daughter, Sophia, works as a music agent, and Sasha and Stefan are songwriters. And Stefan wrote the most moving song when I had cancer, called Pink Ribbons, which is a very beautiful message of hope. But somehow I thought on that island, I didn't really want to remember that time of having cancer and a bad prognosis. So in fact, I chose a song that both of them had done together called Sunrise. And it was a wedding gift that Sasha gave to his Norwegian wife. And I will never forget, we were in the north of Norway, the gulls screaming, a storm brewing up, and he went to the piano and he played this song.
How can I tell you everything that mattered? Everything that mattered changed naturally. So hold on tight now. 'cause I don't know what I'd do.
That was Sunshine, written by your son, Sacha Scarbeck, and sung there by Tom Baxter. It was recorded especially for our programme. Marjorie Wallace, you joined the Sunday Times after your stint working in television. The thalidomide scandal and the uncovering of that was one of your first assignments. I should remind people, of course, that I think it was more than 400 children who were born in the UK, their mothers having taken the thalidomide drug and having been reassured by their GPs at the time that it was safe to take for pregnancy sickness. It proved very much not to be safe to take. How did you do your research with the families as you uncovered this appalling tale?
My job was to go and write stories week after week, which told what it was like to have a child with the kind of deformities that thalidomide had created. So I had to track down these families, and then I would go out and stay with them sometimes. I would know what it was like to hold a 10, 12-year-old, which were then, without arms or legs, what it was like to go into a cafe, say, with an armless, legless child and watch everybody just simply disappear within minutes. Because people at that time didn't want to know about it, and the families were very, very isolated, and many of them were too frightened to speak out because they'd been told it would affect their compensation case. And I wrote about Terry Wiles, one of the thalidomiders, as they call themselves now, and I still remain in touch with many of the thalidomiders who are still fighting now for the other children in countries which did, where they didn't get so much compensation.
Let me ask you about the effect upon you. Of course, you know, you've won a lot of awards for your journalism. You yourself were the mother of young children. How did it affect you?
I felt very deeply for what they were experiencing. I believe and still believe that you can't write about people unless you know what's on their mantelpiece, unless you've been there, unless you've gone out shopping with them, unless you have some understanding of the context of their lives. And some of that has, I guess, rubbed off on me. I've dealt with so many dark stories, dark material, and sometimes I feel as though it's like having been, I think it was once described, tattooed on the inside, that somehow I've carried some of that darkness into me.
Let's go to some more music then, Marjorie Wallace. We're going to go on to your sixth choice of the day.
A few years ago, I met Ray Davis, and we became good friends. And we put on a concert together for Sane's Black Dog campaign. In my choice for the island, I think I would go to one of his legendary songs. And I really love this, Thank You for the Days.
Days I'll remember all my life. Days when you can't see wrong from right. You took my life, but then I knew that very soon you'd leave me. But it's all right. Now I'm not frightened of this world, believe me. I wish today could be tomorrow. The night is dark, it just brings sorrow. Let it wait. Thank you, Father.
That was Ray Davis and the Crouch End Festival Chorus with Days. It will be 30 years, I think, next year, Marjorie Wallace, that you set up Sane. How much progress do you think has been made, particularly in the funding of mental health services?
You've come to the hardest part of it. I wear the hair shirts of having to try and get funds. But there have been some changes, because when I set up Sane, I was a journalist, and it arose from a series of articles that I wrote called The Forgotten Illness. And in those articles, everybody was photographed in the shadows and they had false names. And I decided that we had to make people with mental illness as respected as we do people with cancer, heart disease, or any physical illness.
And so you say that in my question there, the funding of mental health services, I've really gone to the most difficult part, the implication there being that the funding of mental health services is still inadequate. So let me ask you if you think that the bulk of your work has been done in managing to make people feel as though they don't have to sit in the shadows. Do you think the biggest shift in SANE's work has been in changing societal attitudes to mental health problems?
I hope that we've contributed towards changing attitudes and that we've raised some degree of understanding and awareness. All we have really is words and trust. And what we have actually denied people is the continuity of having one person that knows their history, that they can trust. All the changes in the services, the way the landscape has been shifted around, the whole jigsaw of funding and trust has not really helped that person who is in deep distress, who needs somewhere to go when they feel that they can no longer carry on.
You wrote an article once about your own, you described it as melancholia. Why did you decide to talk about that publicly?
Well, I think that it's very important to show that you understand. And I think I also know a little bit about what it is to have that winter of the mind where nothing is moving, where everything is paralysed. And it's a very frightening feeling. And that has made me realise that it's so important that when people are in that state, when they are depressed or very, very anxious, that they don't feel alone. But we also believe very much in research, because until we find the causes, a bit more about how the mind and brain works, we're not going to be able to get the treatments that work, and we're not going to be able to give that hope, and we won't be able to do what happened with cancer, have those kind of cures which can break the stigma. And until we do that, people will go on being afraid of mental illness.
Let's go on then to your seventh disc, Marjorie Wallace. What are we going to hear?
Dr. Tom Margeson, whom I met when I was working in television in the 60s, was, I believe, the cleverest man I've ever met. And I was deeply attached to him. Eventually, 32 years ago, I left the Count and I went to live with Tom. And they were really the happiest days of my life. And we had our daughter, Sophia. And for the first time, I experienced what it was like to live with someone, to share a family. Without him, I doubt if I would have been able to have written my books, nor have founded SANE. And after I got cancer and was in remission, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. For a while, we managed really very well indeed. But the last 10 years of his life, it took a grip first of his body and then of his mind. And when this happened, he wrote beautiful little cards and letters to me, which he would leave on my pillow or leave on the hall table when I came home. And when he couldn't write, what we did was I would dance with him, and we would dance a foxtrot. And then when that couldn't happen, I started singing from my favourite musicals, and I would come in and say, good morning, the sun will soon break through. And he would join in, and he never sung in his life before. And then from then on, we duetted together until the time of his death. And I think those moments are so precious, they're like jewels. They remain in your mind. So I've chosen this Hello, Young Lovers from the King and I because it would bring Tom back to me and remind me of the way that we used to have these duets together.
And faithful and true.
That was Valerie Masterton singing Hello, Young Lovers from the film The King and I. And that was chosen, you said, just as we were listening to the last part of that there, for the love of your life, for Tom, who you spent 30 years you lived together. Marjorie Wallace, you are clearly somebody for whom optimism is still very much alive. What do you put that optimism down to?
Scottish grit, stoicism, and I also think, I hope, with a little bit of elegance and a lightness of touch. And I think what's really important is to have a sense of humour and a sense of mischief.
So by God, you're a survivor. I'm imagining on this island, although you'll, you know, you will doubtless be lonely, you'll survive, don't you think?
Well, I guess as I've survived so much against the odds, I might by fluke survive, but certainly not by my talented DIY. And then I thought, well, maybe, you know, I could find a passing orangutan and persuade him to come and help me with my DIY and build my shelter.
That is indeed optimism. Tell me then about your eighth disc, Marjorie Wallace. What are we going to hear now?
Well, when I was reporting a film for the BBC called Circles of Madness, I wanted to find some music that would transcend all the torment and the mental anguish of the people that I was interviewing, that I was writing about, as well as my own yearning for some kind of inner peace. And I heard this on the radio, and I knew then that this sublime melody was going to give that sense of, it's an old-fashioned word, redemption. It's full of the idea of forgiveness and release, a true freedom.
Repentir by Gounod, sung by Cheryl Studer there, accompanied by the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Jan Marine. It's time then, Marjorie Wallace, for me to give you the books. You get the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare, and you get to take another book too. What will your book be?
Lives of the Poets, 1,000 Years of English and American Poetry.
Right, that will be yours then. And a luxury too.
Could I have a cocktail wardrobe? An elegant evening dress for every day of the week, some party shoes, some sparkly earrings. Then I'd go round, I'd find some champagne that some other castaway had left, and at sundown I would put on my musicals, take my champagne and have a party.
What I'm going to say to you, Marjorie, is that you have been washed up wearing a beautiful cocktail dress and diamonds, and I will furnish you with a beautiful mirrored cocktail cabinet with drinks to go in it. Champagne, I'm guessing, is the one you'd like. Thus far and no further, I will take you with your luxury. And what about the one disc that you want to save? Which one will it be?
It will be Chopin, because whenever I hear Chopin, I know I'm in touch with something really beautiful, and that would make me always feel that life was worth living.
The Chopin it is. Marjorie Wallace, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you, Kirsty. I feel very privileged to have been asked.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.